by, you'll see number one up there, how men are to express themselves in prayer, because that's what the Apostle Paul addresses there in verse 8. I will therefore that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. So, in like manner also that the women. So we need to do justice to this passage by looking at the context, and we did that last week, how men are to express themselves in prayer. Then we're going to get to how women are to express themselves in practice, which we will get to today. Okay, starting. So, I turned it to blue because we're talking about men and how they are to express themselves in prayer. And so I've already quoted verse 8. We see in that verse that his praying should be extensive. His praying should be extensive. And we talked about how he says, I will therefore. So he's even going back from verse 8 to previous verses. Men, I will therefore that men pray everywhere. Definition of a male or a man is an adult male. Thus, Paul is speaking about men in contrast to women in verse 8. And we know it's not the word mankind because it's very strongly the word for a male, an adult male, without a doubt. And then I read you what D. Edmund Hebert, I guess you can see the name there, can't you? I often wonder, should I get that bigger or smaller? I'm trying not to make that the thing that blows out. But he says the men, the men, that's in quotes, that's why you see that apostrophe. The men points specifically to the men as distinguished from the women. The men only are to lead in public prayer. The words also imply that all the men of the congregation were desired to take part in public prayer. So I was challenging the men last week. Listen, you need to be willing to pray in public if called upon. But of course, everybody's thinking about that second sentence, right? Only the men are supposed to lead in public prayer. Only the men. And I'll highlight that because that's the sticking point. Now, to make sure that you understand that that's Hebert's opinion, I gave you the contrasting opinion. This comes from a man by the name of Fetterhoff. The leadership and responsibility for prayer in the public worship service is upon the men, not the women. This does not mean that a woman cannot pray in a public worship service. For Paul gives instructions for a woman's, and it should be, he puts women's, a woman's doing so in 1 Corinthians 11. However, the headship and leadership of the man is to be recognized. And I said, I tend to agree with Hebert and disagree with Fedorov. And I gave you the reasons last week. I disagree with Fedorov for at least these four reasons. Number one, she can obviously pray, but should not lead the men in prayer. Number two, women may lead women in prayer in public. Three, she must pray. If she's going to pray in public in a church service, she needs to have her head covered. I mean, Paul is very explicit about that in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And if you compare 1 Corinthians 11, that Fedorov was quoting and saying, 1 Corinthians 11 says she can pray in public. But if you compare that with 1 Timothy 2:11 to 15 and with 1 Corinthians 14, 34 to 35, I believe you're going to see that Hebert is right. But am I going to separate from somebody over this? No. But it's just something that I believe we need to understand that there are differing opinions on that. Here at Westside, I try to always have the men lead in prayer. Okay. I made this statement that Paul is not appealing to the culture of his day, but to creation itself. You'll see that in verses 13, 14, Adam was first formed. That's creation. Verse 14, Adam was not deceived. The woman being deceived, that's at the time of creation or soon thereafter creation, as far as we know. I talked about how that God ordained discrimination in the Old Testament, that there is God-ordained discrimination in the Old Testament, and there alone we see discrimination because people say, well, that's discrimination. And that's what people would say today. That's discrimination. You know why you're calling it discrimination? Because of the culture. That's why you're calling it discrimination. But God discriminates. Okay? And people say, well, that makes that other person a second-class person. No, it doesn't. We're both in Christ. There's neither male nor female. By the way, sometimes people will use that passage to say, see, God condones transgenderism. You see how you can take something out of context and just say, well, that means this. No, but there is neither male. There's neither Jew nor Gentile. What? What does that mean? You know, in Christ, we are all one. And in Christ, when we get to heaven, folks, it's not going to be, you know, that there's this position and then there's this position. But while we're on this earth, God has given roles that he expects us to abide by. So I listed those God-ordained discriminations in the Old Testament. Priests had to be men. We would call that sexism today. Priests had to be the lead of the tribe of Levi. We would call that tribalism. Levites had to be a certain age. We call that ageism. Priests who offered had to be without certain blemishes. We call that ableism. So there's all kinds of discrimination in the Old Testament. People say, well, we're under the New Testament. I know. 1 Timothy chapter 2. Well, we're seeing it again. Everywhere, this is why I call it his praying should be extensive. Everywhere is literally in every place. So you've translated it this way, I will therefore that men pray in every place. And then I talked about how his praying should be reverent, lifting up holy hands. We know the verses in the Old Testament, Psalm 66, 18, if I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. That's what, when he refers to holy hands, that's really what he's talking about. Isaiah 59, 1 and 2 that you see up there, that the Lord, it's not that he can't hear you, he won't if there's sin in your life. So we talked about the lifting up of holy hands and what that means. It's figurative, a figure of speech that refers to a man whose quality of life, that is his hands, what he has done or is doing, whether that is pleasing to God. Isaiah 1, 15 to 16, and when you spread forth your hands, God says, I will hide mine eyes from you. Yea, when you make many prayers, I will not hear you. I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. The hands and what a person gets involved in. I mean, everything you do, figuratively speaking, you do with your hands. And that man should have clean hands in what he does. It goes on to say, Robertson, H.E. Robertson, and his word pictures in the New Testament. The point here is that only men should lead in public prayer who can lift up clean hands, morally and spiritually clean. By the way, you see in that quote that even A.T. Robertson says it should be the men who lead in prayer. So it expresses reverence that the man's devout / pleasing to God lifestyle is evidenced by the deeds of his hands. And then, of course, he closes with the phrase, without wrath and doubting. And I gave you this verse that really includes both of those. You see the doubting part, the without doubting, in where he says, believe that ye receive them. Therefore I say to you, what things soever you desire when you pray, believe that you receive them. And ye shall have them, and when you stand praying, forgive. That's without wrath, because it really, the wrath has to do with your opinion, your attitude toward other believers. If you have aught against any, that your Father also which is in heaven may forgive you your trespasses. But if ye do not forgive, neither will your Father which is in heaven forgive your trespasses. So now we're ending. We're getting out of the blue, and we're going to go to pink. So are any questions or comments about the pink? The blue. Paul? Isaiah 59, 1 and 2. You want to? Right. This one, there was two I gave. Yeah, I gave two. This is the second one. Is that the one you wanted? Isaiah 1, 15 and 16. I talked about the statement of how people believe, you know, that, you know, when we all pray, especially the men, you should pray with your hands lifted up. And you'll go to services wherever, it's full of this kind of stuff. That is a tremendous distraction. And it's not when they're praying. Sometimes it's when they're, you know, the preacher's preaching, there's people, you know, dancing around, and what a distraction. That's not what this is about. What's talking about, it's a figure of speech that refers to, and I've had people mention this lifting up of holy hands as the reason why when you're in a service and people lift their hands, you shouldn't say anything because, well, you know what? I'm not going to get upset if somebody, you know, when they're praying, if they raise their hands. But if I'm preaching and somebody's out there waving their hands and jumping up and down, that's a distraction. I don't know if I ever told you the story, Rod. I don't know if you were there at Bob Jones when Dr. Paisley was preaching, and there was a guy in Greenville by the name of Sunshine. Anybody, you know who I'm talking about, Rod? You ever heard about Sunshine? Sunshine went to a Baptist church there in Greenville, and Sunshine would get so White Oak Baptist Church. No, not White Oak. It was on White Oak Drive, something. Anyway, when the preacher would get to preaching, I went to a service once, and this guy got up and started running around the edges. He was all excited about what the preacher was preaching. He was waving his hands, and that was that church. It was a total distraction. In fact, some of the guys say, I'm going to such and such a church. No, I want to see Sunshine. There you go. Well, Sunshine, they called him, because he was a very happy man. We were having a Bible conference at Bob Jones. The amphitheater was actually full, 7,000 people. Sunshine sat down on like the fifth row from the preacher. So you can imagine, everybody could see him. And Dr. Paisley started preaching, and Sunshine was getting excited. He was standing and waving his hands. And who did you see? You took your eyes off the preacher. You were no longer hearing what he was saying. Sunshine was such a distraction. I'll never forget this. When Dr. Paisley was done preaching, Dr. Bob Jones Jr. got up. I wish I could talk like he used to talk. He said, there's been a little bird in this room tonight, stealing the word, stealing the seed of the word of God from the hearts of people who are wanting to hear and listen. And he, in his very kind way, said, this is not right. And it wasn't. It wasn't. It was a show. It was ostentatious. So I say that in reference to that lifting up of hands, holy hands. See, this is why I can't ever get through telling stories and so forth. Yeah, Janet, sorry. Right. Could I be here and have you lead in prayer?
Yeah.
I would choose not to, but I have before. By the way, folks, I have had women pray. So I'm telling you, I am not, this is not something I'm going to separate over. My strong preference is I think the men need to be the ones. I'm listening to what Paul says here and so forth. But again, I am not going to get bent out of shape too much. Yes. And if it's just a few men, I usually have the men lead in prayer.
But if it was like all women, like, you know, like, you know, maybe Juanita or, you know, a couple of people stand and pray, would it be kind of that situation? Or would you feel better just like you praying?
I would probably just close in prayer. That would be my preference. Okay?
Two things. It says that if the women pray in public, they have to have their heads
down. Yep. Yes, absolutely. But now, what does he say is the covering? Yeah, read the rest of the chapter. See, folks, this is what you get for not being here last week. I'm giving you a hard time. But I really dealt with that last week, that a woman is to have long hair. And if somebody confuses you with a man, your hair's too short. Okay. All right. Thank you. You can put more in the offering plate then. I like to joke. You know that, Kay?
Yes, I do, sir.
Okay. So here, let's start with verse 9 now. In like manner also that women. Okay. We were talking about the men in verse 8. That women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broided hair or gold or pearls or costly array. Let's talk about that. Let's see what he is talking about here. First of all, Paul is talking about women. Well, what is your definition of a woman, Ketanji Jackson Brown? Who is Ketanji Jackson Brown? Supreme Court Justice now. And she was questioned by, I think it was Blackburn. So can you define woman? And she says, no, I can't. I'm not a biologist. So I can't define woman. So hopefully you can do better. We know that the definition of a man is that, an adult male. So you define what is a woman. You guys are so smart. You see how simple that was? And yet, I mean, I know I'm being very facetious and critical, but we need to be. Critical, the word critical means discerning. And sometimes you have to criticize the untruth that is taking place. Paul is addressing how women are to express themselves. Women, both physically, and that's what we're going to see in verses 9 and 10, and positionally. That's where we're going to get to where the rubber meets the road for most of you. What does the physical have to do with them? I think this is what we need to really address before we get to the positional, because everybody's awaiting the positional verses. But it is interesting that the Bible addresses a woman's physical appearance before her positional, her role. In practice, women are to exercise care in how they express themselves physically. What specifically in verses 9 and 10 then is Paul talking about? How does a woman express herself physically? In what she wears. In what she wears. This is where I make all kinds of enemies. I've heard women say they just want to attend a church where they're not judged by what they wear. I've heard men say the same thing. I just want to go to church where I'm judged by, not by what I wear. Did you know that people judge you anyway? So if somebody comes dressed like they're getting ready to go clean out the barnyard, we're not supposed to judge. But if I come in a coat and tie, I'm judged. It's been reversed. If a man comes to church unshaven, with his hair uncombed, mud on his shoes, tank top, shorts, do you discern something about him? Judge not that you be not judged. If a woman comes to church with a low neckline, sleeveless dress, high heels, a dress just long enough to cover her midsection, her face painted. Do you discern something about her? I'm trying to make a point. Yet, when you see how some folks dress, and not just for church, but dress, especially to come worship God, and if they dress that way, you can't even imagine what they're doing outside of church. Because if they come to church like that, what in the world are they doing on the outside? If a woman's best dress is what she wears to church, then what is happening outside of church? You protest, why are you discussing women's dress? Let's get to this silence thing. Then argue with the Apostle Paul. He's the one who brought this up. I didn't. Because dress, as the women who were here last week admitted, is one way, a big way, that women express themselves. And I'm thankful for it. I am. So before Paul gets to women and their relationship to men, learning in silence, not usurping authority over a man, order of creation, he first addresses in verse 9 how that a woman's physical expression should be reserved. Verse 9, she must be reserved in how she dresses. I'm going to explain why I use the word reserved here in a moment. It's not originally with me. I was reading a commentator when I was thinking this, and he verified it for me. Secondly, her physical dress should be reverent. Those are the two things reserved in verse 9, reverent in verse 10. When men express themselves in prayer, how did we see that they are to do so in the last part of verse 8? We saw that his praying should be extensive in every place and that his praying should be reverent. What's the second thing for the ladies expressing themselves physically? That it should be with reverence. For the man, that reverence is indicated by lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. So Paul is continuing his thought, expressed with now in like manner. Here's how the man expresses himself reverently in prayer. Here's how the woman expresses herself reverently in her way she dresses. That's what he actually hits there in verses 9 and 10. So Paul is continuing his thought. So let's look at the fact that physically, she should be very reserved in how she dresses. You say, how do you know that he's talking about dress? I think that's pretty plain when you read, and I'll read this and you follow along. In like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest. What's apparel? That's what you put on. So that is the very topic, the subject that he is talking about. So I ask again, is it true that women express themselves physically by the way they dress? It is. So do men. But it really becomes more of an issue with women. Why? Men are very sight-oriented. And if women don't learn this early on, you're going to cause many men to fall. I hope you can see how I get upset about that. Here's a word that the Apostle Paul uses there in verse 9. Shamefacedness. That has to do with dress. Shamefacedness. And so I'm quoting, and here's what really brought me onto this, using the word reserved. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of a man by the name of Richard Trench. He wrote a book way back in the 1900s, on synonyms in the New Testament. So Greek synonyms. And he had this word, or this to say about that word shamefacedness. The word connotes feminine reserve in matters of sex. In the word is involved an innate moral repugnance to the doing of the dishonorable. It is. He's got this other word for shamefacedness. He said it's shamefastness, which shrinks from transgressing the limits of womanly reserve and modesty. Now, that's very full. That's a lot to think about. But it's that part that he is using there about reservation. She should be reserved in what she dresses like. So if you look up the word, the noun reserve in the dictionary, what does reserve mean? It means self-restraint in expression. Self-restraint in expression. And how do ladies express themselves? By their dress. Reticence. So in her attire, the godly woman uses self-restraint. She's very careful how she dresses. She is reticent to wear anything that may draw attention to her in a sensual way. Very, very reserved. Very careful. Very concerned. It used to be, I was thinking about this as I was preparing, it used to be that it was women who were very reserved and conservative in their dress, lest somebody would think of them in a bad way. And that bad way being very loose. But since the 1960s, and what happened in the 1960s? The sexual revolution. That's when the skirts got hiked up.
Thanks to Elvis.
Well, thanks to the women, they responded to Elvis. And it was really with the advent of the miniskirt that they became loose and edgy in their dress, unreserved. They may be quiet in their voice. Verses 11 and following. But she is screaming with her dress. Do you get, do you see how verses 9 and 10 connect with verses 11 to 15? And why Paul is addressing dress first? Because he can address, you know, the women remaining silent and so forth first and then get to the dress. But he's saying now, first of all, watch out how you express yourself or the way you dress. Because that is very obvious. Sometimes women dress and it's very much in your face. It is significant that when Paul refers to devout men, he refers to their hands as evidence. You get to verse 10, and women who profess godliness. So you're there with devoutness again. He says in like manner, and when referring to women as professing godliness, he refers to their apparel as evidence. He refers to man's hands as evidence of their godliness. He refers to women and how they dress as professing godliness. We'll treat the verse 9, with the words in the order as they appear in the Greek New Testament, because it's always interesting to see in what order. So again, my translation is going to be stilted. And we've already looked at the first three words, in like manner, but I'm including the word also. We've also talked about women, so in like manner also that women, and then what's the next word? Adorn. Adorn is not the next word in the Greek New Testament. Here's a literal translation. Here's that stiltedness. Likewise, also women in clothing modest. They always put the adjective after the noun. In clothing modest with unpretentiousness. That word unpretentiousness is the shamefacedness here. And self-control to be adorning. See how late adorning comes in? To be adorning themselves. So what's Paul emphasizing? Modest clothing. Unpretentious clothing. Self-control. Adorning themselves. And then he says, not in braided hair and gold or pearls or clothing that's very expensive. Costly array. Go. So there's the verse as I translate it. Now, so let's go back. And since he talks about clothing, first of all, that's the next word. It's the word apparel. Or attire. What a woman wears, would you agree with me, says much about what kind of a woman she is without her even saying a word. When Solomon speaks of the strange woman, what's the strange woman in the book of Proverbs? It's a harlot, it's a prostitute, it's a whore. You know what he refers to? There met him a woman with the clothing of a harlot and subtle of heart. So now I'm going to get into some articles that I've got here. This is what you're waiting for, I know. Every preacher has a file of saving material. My file goes back to, early 2000s where I started. You don't need to know all that. Anyway, I've got this article here, Lesbian Criticizes Feminine Dress. Lesbian author Virginia Mollenklot, in her book, Omnigender, A Trans-Religious Approach. By the way, this was back in 2006. Describes her aversion to wearing dresses. Quote, I feel myself to be female, all right, but masculine at the same time. So that dresses and skirts feel rather ridiculous. And this despite the fact that as a child, I was not allowed to wear overall shorts or pants. Brackets. She grew up in a fundamentalist home. End brackets. One of the greatest benefits, she says, of coming out publicly as lesbian was that I could go through my closets and give away all my dresses and skirts. This lesbian's admission that dresses are feminine reminds us that clothing is a form of language. That's what I'm talking about. It's how you express yourself. It's a form of language. We make social statements by our clothing choices. In Western society, and then it goes on and talks more about this. There's that first article. Then I've got this one. Jesse went to Northridge. When Benjamin, This is back in 2000. This is the Northridge High School. They sent this home with the students. They have a dress code. At least they did. I don't know whether they enforced it. But here's what they said. Here's what it says. And I'm going, wow, what? If I would say this in church, they'd say I was a legalist. Let me read you what Northridge said about their girls. Skirts, shorts must be at least mid-thigh length. Now, that's still too short. But there it is. Has to be mid-thigh. Clothing which promotes alcohol, drugs, tobacco, gang affiliation, sexual innuendos, or profanity will not be allowed. Now, I'm just reading you a part of it. Those were the two parts I thought, that's interesting. That they're really watching how those no halter tops, tank tops, and so forth. Boys cannot wear tank tops. And I'm not even sure they enforced the dress code they did, because I was looking at Brandon and Jesse, who both would, yeah, Jesse. Yeah. What are guys doing? They're gawking. It's distracting. Okay, next word. In my Greek translation up here, you get to clothing, and then he modifies clothing with, what's the next word? Modest. It's interesting. When you look at that word modest, it means respectable, honorable clothing. So her clothing must be respectable. It must be honorable. To get the idea, I like to ask, okay, how would you describe clothing that is not respectable and that is not honorable on a woman? Well, that's clothing that's immodest. That's why the King James translators use the word modest. The same word is used only one other time in the New Testament, that word modest. And it's in the very next chapter. You're in 1 Timothy 2? Go to chapter 3. And here's where that word is used again, but it's translated so much differently. It's verse 2. A bishop, a pastor then, must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach. I'm curious if you can figure out where that same word appears there in chapter 3 and verse 2, because it's hard. It's hard to distinguish it. Janet? Nope, not sober. Sorry? You have a different translation, I believe. I think it may be the same word. It's of good behavior. Of good behavior. So the word translated modest in 2:9, in 3:2 is of good behavior. So that clothing is a reflection of behavior. Good or bad? Next article. Wall Street Journal, 2016. I'll prove it to you. Wall Street Journal, okay? Because everybody's going to go, oh, it's not in the Wall Street. Yeah, it is. Dress for success and perhaps be a success. New studies suggest that when workers wear nicer clothes, they achieve more. They're so legalistic there. A number of recent studies, dress better, work better, Ray Smith says. A number of recent studies suggest that dressing up for work in a suit or blazer could do wonders for an employee's productivity. I'm skipping through this. Wearing nicer clothes may raise one's confidence level. Skipping again. In some cases, even boost the level of one's abstract thinking. Oh, I'm going way on through. Those more casually dressed on the other side of the table tend to back down more easily. Other research suggests that the effects of wearing nice clothes can be as much internal as external. People engage in higher levels of abstract thinking when they dress up compared with when they dress casually. You know what's kind of interesting is if you have a workplace where they have a dress down Friday or something, do you notice a change in everybody's kind of demeanor? People say that what you wear doesn't affect you. Oh, yes, it does. It does. For men, A full suit, sport coat, or even a tie can put you in a more professional mindset. Wearing a high-quality dress, shoe, or nice watch can do the trick as well. I mean, the whole point is does your dress have anything to do with, you know, how you can achieve more, how you can think better? I can tell you this. When I was a student at BJ, the guys had to wear a shirt and tie, and their pants had to be no jeans, and you had to wear a shirt and tie during morning classes. In the afternoon, you could take your tie off. You say, well, where's that in the Bible? It's not. It was a matter of teaching discipline and saying, you know, we want you guys to learn how to, you know. And I noticed that when the dress standards would drop, how guys would sit in class. And things began to fall. Karen? You have to speak up.
Everybody had a dress code. In fact, they enforced it to the point that if you did not wear your uniform to work, that you would be dismissed.
I am so much more open to a guy who comes to my house to work on something if he's wearing a nice uniform. I'm like, okay, he has enough respect for his job to do. He probably has some respect for how well he does his work or not. I'm being a judge. I know. Ooh, this is interesting. The inside scoop on guys. We got this in the mail. I don't know if my wife remembers this. And on the other side, you got guys. And so when you turn it over, you get the guys. Turn it over, you get the girls. But I read this years ago, so I highlighted some things. It comes from, I have it up there, Human Life Alliance. This is not a religious organization, but it's a very conservative secular organization, apparently so. Girls, the next time you do your final mirror check in the morning, think about this. The way you dress is a crucial element in staying abstinent until marriage. Most of us, talking about girls here, not me, want to look cute and fashionable. We find ourselves competing with the most local fashionistas and even our own girlfriends to be the first to wear the latest thing. It's okay to want to look good, but if we don't make wise fashion decisions, we may attract the kind of attention that you don't necessarily want. Most guys are driven by what they see. Most? They're visual. So when a girl dresses in clothes that overly accentuate the shape of their bodies, like tight pants or shirts that leave a lot of bare skin, it's difficult for guys not to notice. I wish you girls would understand that. They become aroused by what they see. You might think it's their problem, but guys are wired differently from girls in what turns them on. This shouldn't give guys a license to stare or permission to objectify, but some will. When I was in high school and girls started wearing short dresses, you know what guys were saying? If it's not for sale, don't advertise it. You can help guys by dressing modestly. I think Paul might be onto something here. Or maybe they're onto something that Paul said years ago. This will also be of help to you by boasting your self-esteem, and self-respect. Dressing modestly is a practical step to choosing abstinence and saving sex for marriage. That's just interesting that somebody in a secular world would say what the Bible is saying. So the inside scoop on guys. And then I've got this one. I've got to close. I've only got a few minutes, but I've got to get to this while we're on it. There's this article called Clothing Matters, What We Wear to Church. Why What We Put On May Be More Important Than We Think by Dwayne Litvin. And it's by this really Bible-strong fundamentalist. No, Christianity Today. Okay? Christianity Today is, I mean, this was back in 2012. And they've gone downhill since then too. But I mean, even in 2012, this is totally new evangelical, liberal Christianity. And this Dwayne Litvin, this is a really interesting article. So I'm going to, the article's like 9 pages long, so I'm only going to do the section that he hits on right here. But he introduces it this way. Relaxed, even rumpled informality is in. Suiting up in our Sunday best is out. The question I want to raise here is, what should we make of this shift in worship attire? Many seem convinced it's a good thing because, again, it's the heart that counts. Yet precisely for this reason, because it is the heart that counts, I want to suggest that what we wear in our public worship may matter more than we think. To grasp this connection, let us draw on some helpful insights from the field of communication. So, I'm going to skip around like crazy, but I'm going to put some of it up on the screen. Some experts estimate that in our everyday relationships, only a small percentage of what we communicate is conveyed by verbal channels. The rest is conveyed non-verbally. Of special interest here is that avenue of non-verbal communication we call physical appearance and dress. What's Paul addressing here? The physical. Here are 7 observations drawn from the literature on this aspect of our human interaction. Number 1, the wearing of clothing is exclusively a human characteristic. When was the last time your dog put pants on? Okay? It's distinctively human. We share many attributes with other creatures, but the inclination to clothe ourselves is not one of them. Those who know the account of Adam and Eve will understand why this is so. There is a moral and even spiritual dimension to human clothing. 2, our clothes serve a variety of practical, social, and cultural functions. Protection and modesty spring first to mind, but our clothes do far more. We sometimes dress to conceal or deceive. More often, our clothes serve to reveal. We use clothing for decoration, for sexual attraction, for a self-expression. Talking about how women express yourselves. And self-assertion. By our attire, we display our gender. At least it used to be that way. Our religion, our occupation, our social position. And that's what Paul addresses next. Or causes with which we identify. Example, sports jerseys. Our apparel may express our group membership of our role in society, company or police uniforms. Many dress to impress while others choose the reverse. They express their rejection by intentionally flouting accepted clothing norms. Number 3. There are 7 of these. That's why I'm reading so fast. Our clothing is one of our most elemental forms of communication. Long before our voice is heard, our clothes are transmitting multiple messages. From our attire, others immediately read not only things such as our sex, age, national identity, socioeconomic status, and social position, but also our mood, our attitudes, our personality, our interests, and our values. What does how you dress communicate to the world out there about your values? We constantly make judgments about one another on the basis of what you wear, clothing. Common wisdom has it that you can't judge a book by its cover, but this is only partly true. We regularly read one another's covering. What's more, we're better at it than we think. Research suggests that if you stand someone before an audience of strangers and ask that audience to draw inferences merely on the basis of what they see, the audience's inferences will tend toward consensus, and those inferences will tend to be more or less accurate. Why should this be? We spend our lives making judgments based on appearance and then testing those judgments in our subsequent relationships. In this way, we become rather adept at the process. Judgments based on appearance are scarcely infallible, of course, and we are wise to hold them tentatively, but it's almost impossible to avoid making them in the first place. Number 5, because our clothing is one of the fundamental ways we communicate with others, what we wear is never a purely personal matter. Our attire exerts a social influence on those around us. One famous study, for example, discovered that unwitting subjects were significantly more willing to jaywalk when following individuals wearing high-status clothing than when following individuals wearing low-status clothing. I thought that was interesting. So if I'm dressed in a suit and I jaywalk, somebody will be more tend to follow me. Why? Well, he's at this status. If he can do, well, okay, I can follow. That's what Dwayne is saying right here. What we wear can shape patterns of communication around us, depending on what messages people are picking up. Consider, for example, the varied cues we send by the way we dress. Quote, I want people to notice me. I'm very confident. Or I want to hide. Or I only care about comfort. Or I want to look seductive. Or I repudiate you and your expectations. That's not in here, but that's what I'm adding. How we dress not only affects others, it also affects us. This dynamic is often circular. How we feel, emotions, influences the clothes we put on. And the clothes we put on, by the way, folks, I would not have worn this suit today. It is uncomfortable. I'm hot, and I don't like this around my neck. But I do it for a reason, but I'm getting off. There's one of those rabbit trails, okay? It influences how we feel, influences the clothes we put on, and the clothes we put on in turn shape how we feel. So what you put on actually affects your emotions. Changes of clothes can generate a change of mood. The soldier feels different in his uniform than he does in street clothes. In some settings, our choice of attire can rank, make or break us. If we like the way we look for a job interview, for instance, it will tend to strengthen our confidence. We feel better about our chances as reflected in improved posture, more fluent speech, more dynamic gestures. On the other hand, inappropriate dress can sap our confidence. We have all experienced the uncomfortable effects of feeling underdressed in a particular social setting. Have you ever felt that way? Ooh. Oh, boy, here's this. Okay, I got it. Years ago, and this just hit me. Just a few years ago, I've been away from Bob Jones now for 28 years, but I used to give speeches in Vespers, what they called Vespers. There'd be a crowd of the Rhoda Haver Auditorium held 2,700. I know that because I'm thinking, I'm going to get up there and I'm going to say how many people are going to be watching. So I looked it up. It was 2,700. I've had dreams ever since that I got up there and I forgot to put everything on but my underwear. You talk about feeling undressed. And I would sweat. I would wake up in a nightmare. And I was like, oh. Yeah, since we've been married, hon. I just never told you about that. But you ever felt underdressed? It's a nightmare. Last one. Much of the social meaning of our clothing is contextual. The appropriateness of our dress is often dictated by the situation. Dress that would send a given message in one setting might send a very different message in another. Picture, for example, a young woman dressed in hiking boots, sweatshirt, and so forth. Around a campfire, the message might be merely, I'm ready for the trail. Choosing that same outfit for her aunt's funeral would say something rather different. Regional variations and issues of local dress loom large. Times change, values change, situations change. What was proper 10 years ago may not be proper today, or vice versa. Yeah, it's your setting. 2 weeks ago, when I went to that church out there in Meeker, all I had was my hunting clothes. I chose to go. I didn't have a coat and tie there in the tent with me, smelling like smoke. That was from the campfire, not cigarettes. All of the above is why we should not conclude too quickly that because God looks on the heart, what we wear to church doesn't matter. Our internal and external states cannot be so easily disentangled. The fact is, when it comes to how we clothe ourselves, our external appearance is often an expression of our internal state. Thus, our worship attire may matter more than we think. That is the statement I wanted to get to. Our external is an expression internal. People say you shouldn't judge me by the way I dress. Well, it just indicates to me what's happening on the inside. Yeah, but God looks on the outside, on the inside. That's right. I can't. All I have to go by is what's on the outside to tell me what's on the inside. And I'm way over, but comments or questions, because man, now we've got some. Oh man, look at the hands. Okay. He's bringing you a microphone. I'm sorry, Kelly. We're having this tape, so the world's listening too.
The comment I want to make is that I key in on the word respect, starting at the level of, first of all, respect for yourself, dress in an appropriate way that doesn't put it on sale, respect for the people around you. Mm-hmm. The people in church around you don't want to see that you're putting it on sale. Respect for where you're going. You're in God's house. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, respect for God himself.
That's very good. Very good. Thank you. Kay, right over here. That's very good.
I agree with Kelly about respect, but when you mentioned miniskirts, I thought about, at the same time, we wore rib tickler blouses that exposed your midriff.
Yeah, and that doesn't affect a guy at all. It does. Paul?
In personal experience, when I have people come in for an interview, if they come in with inappropriate clothing, I automatically hand them an application to fill out and tell them that we'll call them back if we're hiring. But also, I had a gal come in who was wearing very, very immodest short skirt, and I said, "What you're wearing is absolutely awful." And she said, "Well, I want people to look at me."
Yeah.
What she didn't realize afterwards was how many women who look at her are critical and just say, "What an awful outfit. What does she think she is? Who yeah. is she? What kind of a person she is?" She was judged as harshly by other ladies.
Yes.
And not even a Christian, not in a Christian environment either. Yeah. But women don't go for that.
Yeah. There were so many other points I was going to make that, you know, we can have lunch at 1 instead of 12 if you want. But I hope you're here next Sunday, because we're getting close to let the women remain silent. Janet, don't be silent. Go ahead and speak up. Oh, yeah, it's coming. Sorry.
I had two things to say. First one is when I work, I wear scrubs, obviously, and it's not required for the private duty nursing that I'm doing now, but I choose to, not only because for one thing they're modest, but also they can get dirty and I can just toss them in the wash, but also when I wear scrubs, I always wear an undershirt underneath, just because the way I'm built, a lot of times the scrubs go very low, and doing my work, I don't take a chance in being immodest.
Yeah.
Also, the other thing is, I'm similar in age to the mom of the little girl that I work with, and I don't want, if I'm out in public, especially with her, I want it to be known, you know, I am a nurse. I am not, it's not like a homosexual relationship kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I've always been careful as far as, you know, what I wear. And I've had it, you know, people say, you know, I appreciate, you know, I put my hair up and try to act yeah. professionally. The other thing is, when Dave and I were dating, we had one of our conversations, we were talking about clothing, and I said, you know, if I ever wear something, you know, I try very hard not to wear something that he would, you know, be offended by or you know, have problems with. But I said, if I ever do, you know, let me know, tell me.
Thank you for saying that, because that's one of the statements I was going to make, that you ladies sometimes don't know that what you're wearing actually is something you should not, and your husband should be the one to tell you. It shouldn't happen. You shouldn't be coming to church and, you know, I've got to go, oh. We did that once where there was a lady who came. It was in the winter. They came. And she was dressed appropriately, but when summer came and she was teaching Sunday school, this is like the first year, and her clothes came off. And I tell my wife, I said, honey, you're going to have to tell her. That's just not appropriate. And my wife, you know my wife, how mean she is. No, I'm serious. My wife, in the gentle way that she has, went to her and said, you know, what you're wearing is just, who are you to judge? And she grabbed her husband and walked out of the church for the last time with him going, yeah, now you know who was wearing the pants or whatever. But so, yeah, the husband needs to be the one who says, my wife is very good at saying, what do you think about this? So, last comment, Linda.
When I was 16 years old and I wore a top that wasn't appropriate and I was going out on a date, my father stopped me. He said, honey, that isn't appropriate blouse. Would you please change that for me? He says, you don't know how men think. And I didn't. So I changed.
Yeah.
in respect for my father. And
that's good. That's good. Praise the Lord for a good father. Okay, let's close in prayer. Lord, thank you for